Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Recruiting Animal. You know, I was talking to JD Jason Davis, as usual, the other day, and he says to me, Animal, what's wrong? He said, you seem a bit down today. And I answered him. I was very honest. I said, you know, I do have a bit of a problem. I just have no hate in me this week, and no one's angry at me. So how am I going to do my radio show? I was really worried. I got the answer. He said, I've got a contest going, and all the losers are going to hate the judge, so why don't you be the judge? He says, and after you announce your choice, we can have like a struggle session where all the losers get on the radio and shout at you. He said, he was really getting excited, and we had to go outside. We were at Starbucks. He said it's going to be great. And I said, hey, sounds good. But I got David Kippen coming on the show already. What am I going to do with this guy? I can't just invite him and then leave him out. He said, don't worry, you're dealing with recruiters. There's lots of hate to go around. So, without further ado, let me say, live from Toronto, with JD Jason Davis and Dr. David Kippen on the judges panel, I'm the Recruiting Animal, and this is a Recruiting Animal Show!
The werewolf is neither man nor wolf, but a satanic creature with the worst qualities of both. And do you expect me to believe that a man so afflicted actually becomes a wolf under the influence of the full moon? I'm afraid, sir, that I gave up my belief in goblins, witches, personal devils, and werewolves at the age of 6.
Well, I got to bring some of my personal devils onto the show right now, but I'm having a problem accessing them. Oh, hold on a second. Wait a second. Here we go. Here's a few people coming on. Let's see. JD Jason Davis, are you there yet? No. Let's look for Dr. David Kippen. Dave, are you on yet?
Yeah, hey, how are you?
Hey, great. JD, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, everybody's here now. Okay, so now, you guys didn't know it, but you're going to help me make my choice for the contest. For J.D. Jason Davis is running a contest on recruitingblogs.com, his new blog. I don't know what you call it. But first, I want to introduce Dave. Dave, I'm going to introduce you first. Is that okay?
Awesome.
Okay. You can hear me, right?
Absolutely.
I'm going to ask you some questions. But I got to tell you up front, I like it when people talk fast and get right to the point. You know, I know you're the guest, but I've got an audience here. They don't know ums, no ahs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got
okay. you. Okay, good. Dave, who are you? What do you do? What does TMP do? What's your title? You go ahead. I'll give you free reign.
Hey, I thought you were going to introduce me. All right, so I head up Global Brand Strategy.
That's the way I introduce people. Don't complain. I told you.
I head up Global Brand Strategy for TMP. No ums or ahs. Working, except for that one, working with large clients, we develop brand positions to help them attract talent. TMP is the world's largest recruitment advertising agency in the independent space. And I think of the work I do as being at the leading edge of what TMP does.
Okay, what does the independent space mean?
Means that we're not owned by Monster, we're not owned by Yahoo, we're a separate independent agency.
I thought you were part of Monster.
No, we went private last year. It was a big moment for us. There were a lot of advantages to TMP to have the Monster relationship, but there also are a lot of advantages to being a privately held company. So late last year, we went private and haven't looked back since. It's been fantastic.
Okay. Did that have anything to do with you coming aboard in 2005?
You know, I wish I could say I moved that kind of mountain, but no, it didn't. It had to do with larger business drivers. It really had to do with Monster focusing on its core business as a job board and us focusing on our core competence, which was recruitment advertising. You know, there was a great fit when initially back in the 90s we bought Monster, grew the job board, but eventually it grew to a thing of its own. And it just made a lot more sense where we were to part ways and each work on what we specialize.
Okay, enough of that. Listen, here's my definition of a brand. It's a group of ideas you associate with a person or thing. If I say the Recruiting Animal Show is fun for the whole family, that's my brand, right?
No, that's part of it.
Well, what's the rest?
Well, I think brand's a lot more than that. I really think it's everything that everybody thinks about, well, to use a recruiting animal, about you, your space, but also everybody competing with you in your space, the space itself, the products, in this case jobs, everything about you. So, for example, if I say Apple, you're not just going to think about the product. You're eventually going to think about iPods. You're going to think about music. Before long, you'll be thinking about Microsoft. So you're thinking about the competitive space. You're going to think about the business strategy. It's really all of that. So the brand is everything. And I think what you're talking about is branding. It's what part of how do you shine the light on those particular elements you want your, in this case, audience to focus on.
Okay, so now we're talking about dynamics, and I want to, like a dynamic process, a moving process. Here's an example I was thinking of when I was thinking about the show. Look at Madonna. Everybody always says she's reinventing herself, right?
Yeah.
That's one of her trademarks, isn't it? That's her brand, the woman who reinvents herself. But to me, she seems like the same thing all the time, a bad girl, right? I don't want to say anything rougher. It's a family show, fun for the whole family. She's a bad girl. Her brand is very consistent. Would you say so?
Well, I'd say that there are consistent brand elements. I mean, look, you've got the name, you've got what she looks like, you've got the fact that she's in music. Obviously, some things aren't going to change, but I think that there's a lot of innovation in that brand.
Give me an example.
Well,
she gets dirtier. She got dirtier over time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's even beyond that. It's about the costume changes, the changes in music, the changes in her personification. I honestly, I have to say, I haven't followed Madonna very closely, but if you want to bring it to the product space, I think if you compare...
I didn't say I want to, but you go ahead.
Thank you. If you compare Apple and Microsoft, there's a similarity between maybe Madonna and the Apple brand being a little bit edgy, a little bit forward-leaning, always pushing the envelope a little bit, and Microsoft and... maybe more conservative on-brand groups like, say, the Rolling Stones that consistently year after year after year do subtle variations on the same thing they've been doing since they started. Not a qualitative judgment, but just a question of how far you push the image of yourself, your brand identity.
Okay, now I got to tell you, I didn't even know until about maybe a year ago that there was an entire business sector called recruitment advertising. Sorry, maybe I'm dumb or ignorant, or maybe I'm just up in Canada. But how does what you're talking about now relate to recruiting and like recruitment advertising? In the end, I'm going to want to relate it to the individual recruiter, but you go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great question. So recruitment advertising really started as an aggregation of mom-and-pop shops, right? Recruitment advertising was originally done very, very locally. People basically... saying, I will place all your ads, business, because I know it's a pain to put ads in. It grew year over year in the print space very slowly. I think recruitment advertising as a really separate industry took off when online took off, because the methods of outreach changed so much. The large organizations, which are typically the drivers of innovation in all HR areas, said, look, we can't expect our internal recruiters to become experts in things like building web pages. They just can't do it. So we need professional help. Agencies who already existed in the print space jumped in to help. And as the tools got more sophisticated, the conversation got more sophisticated, and I'd say the industry really professionalized from about 1997 to today into something that really does exist with a heft of its own. I think the big debate in the recruitment advertising space is, are we really in the advertising space or in the HR space? And I think you'll find a wide range of competencies across that spectrum, with some very strongly in HR that, frankly, aren't very sophisticated in advertising, and some at the other end of the spectrum who have almost forgotten that HR is a client.
So hold on a sec. So the way I see it is, you're like the marketing department, and the recruiters are like the salespeople. Is that right? Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. But I think at the end of the day, we're a lot more than a marketing department, because we're not internal. We're really, I think the better analogy is, we're like a consumer ad agency, but we work in the employment space.
So, okay. Let's put that to the side. How do you change your brand? Now, here's the reason I ask it, okay? I'm going to use a down-home example. I know lots of people. All of a sudden, Bobby becomes Bob. Judy becomes Judith. We got a good friend. Anthony, he used to be Tony. You know, I tend to resist that kind of thing. Those guys are trying to change their brands, aren't they?
Yeah, in a way. They're actually changing their branding. They're changing their names, right? The question is, when Judith becomes Judy, is she changing her identity? Is she trying to say, listen, I want to shine a light on different parts of my personality than I've been shining on it before? And I think that's what you're really resisting. What's in a name, right? It doesn't really matter. What does matter is what the attributes the name conjures up are. So you're right. Most people are really resistant when a company or an individual tries to become something fundamentally different. Going back to what we were saying about Madonna, I think one of the reasons that you brought her up is because her career has been about doing that, and she's kind of unique in that. You wouldn't expect, for example, Rush Limbaugh to suddenly become a touchy-feely Dr. Phil kind of character. I think it would be very difficult, even if he were so inclined, for him to undergo that kind of a personal public transformation, even if in his heart of hearts, that's who he really is.
Okay, but his brand actually changed when he was exposed as being addicted to painkillers. Is that fair?
Yeah, but his brand was changed. He didn't do what you're talking about. He didn't go out and say, okay, I want to be somebody new. The marketplace changed it, just like you could say Enron's brand was changed and Arthur Andersen's brand was changed by public insights into the organizations, and it hurt a lot. That kind of brand change, from a public relations standpoint, you try to manage because you really can't do anything purposeful about it. What you were asking about, though, is more like when American Express spun off its financial advisory services and they became Ameriprise. Now this organization is in the position of trying to say, well, we were under the American Express badge, but now you've never heard about us. But that's kind of a good thing because it gives us an opportunity to talk about something new and something different that you might not want to associate with cards like saving for retirement.
Okay. How important is branding to hiring or recruiting, et cetera? And how come I started hearing about it, like I told you in my email, all of a sudden, employment branding is like a huge issue. John Sullivan writes about it all the time. I never heard of it before.
It's a great question, and I think we need to first take a step back and look at where recruiting feels pain. Employment branding only targets one segment of the recruitment spectrum, and that is where there's a hard-to-fill employment area. We typically are engaged when clients are looking for a really small pool of workers, be it a healthcare system looking for physicians, an engineering company looking for engineers, when there are more people looking for talent than there is talent to be found. Or to put it in a different way, when it's a seller's market on the talent side, and the employer is in the position of having to say, okay, prospect, talent, person I want to hire, what is it about what I offer that could make somebody like you come work here beyond pay and benefits? And
so
all
give me an example. How does that translate into something you've done? Can you use an example?
Sure. So I worked with a large healthcare system in the Western United States who is trying to find physicians, and they're competing with everybody else who's trying to find physicians. There are too many hospitals, there are too many needs, there aren't enough physicians, so for physicians, it's a seller's market. They can go wherever they want. So we had to do a lot of research to talk to physicians and find out what is it you want from your employment relationship. Do you want the latest technology? Do you want more people to help you in an administrative way? Do you want to be in a really prestigious neighborhood? Well, it turned out it was largely about, I want you to talk to my whole family, not just me. I want you to help me understand if you want me to relocate from location A to location B, what are the schools like? What kinds of homes are available there? What's my quality of life going to be? And beyond all the stuff that I expect any good hospital is going to offer me, up-to-date equipment, you know, you don't have a bad reputation, you're not cutting the wrong legs off at the wrong time, all of that stuff. Beyond that, what kind of intrinsic benefits am I going to get? Am I going to be able to hold up my head and say, I work for this great system? That's what they wanted. That's what the research showed. And then the advertising challenge was, okay, how do you boil that all down so that in a display ad, a web posting, an email blast, or a handshake card, or in the case of physician recruiting, in the phone calls recruiters make, we can put that into a small, succinct few sentences.
Now, I read your old blog, and you said there's a problem with that, because you said recruiters do just what you said. They use the marketing brand created by guys like you, they use that as a come-on or a sale, a selling feature or the benefits, whatever you want to call it, when they call the physician or whatever candidate they're after. But you said on your blog, when a person finally gets into the department, it's got its own brand and its own culture that's often unrelated to the organization brand, and that's a huge problem, and that's a retention problem, right?
You're exactly right. Well, so here's the disconnect I was writing about. When I talk to clients about this early in the process, when we're having the same conversation about why in the world should we do this, we talk about something I call the aspiration gap. In consumer advertising, listen, I'm trying to sell you a product, and at the end of the day, once I've got your money and you've got my product, chances are the sale is done. In the employment space, that sale is redone every day I come to work as your employee. So the challenge is the aspiration gap, the difference between what I sell you on and what I deliver to you has to be vanishingly small. So if you don't know exactly what it is that the real work experience delivers, you're in a really tough place. What I was writing about was recruiters often want to say, okay, tell me the 8 or 10 wonderful things talent wants to hear, and I'll fill seats with those 8 or 10 things. What they need to say is, here are the 8 or 10 things talent wants to hear. Here are the 2 or 3 that actually are true for us. We're going to build positioning around those 2 or 3, defend it, market it, and that's what drives retention.
Yeah, but you see, what I heard, and I want to move on. I won't stay on this too long, but we might come back to it. You're saying that, you know, you pick out a few things that people want to hear and you ignore the rest. It sounds like that to me, because you said in your article as well that those departmental issues are very hard to change. All that an HR department or a company can do is have an internal brand, their sort of internal propaganda, so everybody, including the managers and the employees, they get an idea of the standard they're supposed to work up to, but you can't change things immediately or directly. So if you're selling a job and really the department's a mess, there's not much you can do about it except, you know, don't feature those negative aspects. Is that right?
Well, that's kind of right. I mean, look, they call it work for a reason. You know, we're not paid to go play. Every job, and I think all adults would agree on this, has its own challenges. Every employer has their own challenges. Some are situational. I work in a crappy environment. Some of them have to do with the sector. My job may not be very interesting. Whatever they are, people are generally willing to accept a certain measure of work in working. The point I was trying to make is, number one, HR is usually tasked with retention, and sometimes if HR doesn't have its hands on the operational level, operational levers, that's an unreasonable ask. If you want to make HR truly accountable for retention, you have to make it possible for HR to make changes in operations. But if you can't do that, and even if you can, you can't change everything about some work, what you have to do is you have to focus on what's true and real about what your work experience offers. So the point I was really trying to get at is it's advertising, but what you're really advertising in the recruitment space has to be true, as distinct from product advertising, where a lot of spin is not only possible, it's what you're supposed to do.
Okay, I got another question. You were in China recently, right?
Yeah.
You know, people go to Italy and they're looking for, like, the mother of all pizzas, you know, because it's the home of the pizza. If you go to Shanghai, can you get a good chop suey there? Or are you going to be disappointed, just like the people who go to Italy, what they get is like a kind of a piece of bread with some spice on it and a little tomato sauce?
Well, I have to say that the best food I ate in China was not in Shanghai. It was in Chengdu, which is in the heart of the Sichuan province. The food there is absolutely amazing. But, yeah, you can get great noodles in Shanghai. I wasn't on a dinorama.
I said chop suey.
Well, I know. I said noodles. I wasn't really looking for chop suey. I didn't go on a dinorama. I'm not much of a foodie, but I can tell you the experience there is absolutely fantastic. The city is on fire. It's growing at an absolutely unbelievable rate. And I think for me the most amazing thing is the degree to which it's growing in all directions, which is to say not in terms of the height of the buildings or anything, but it is westernizing, it's easternizing, it's really trying to become, I think, a hub, a mecca, a center of the Orient and a cross-proliferation point between the East and the West. And it's doing an amazing job.
Great. Glad to hear it. Listen, we got to go to one of the contestants. I'm going to run a story by you. JD, are you there?
I'm here.
Anybody else can pipe in if they want. I'm going to tell you guys, one of the contestants, and give you my opinion, and you can give me yours. This guy is named Rob McIntosh. We all know him, Dave, very well. He told a story. He said he was working in a third-party recruiter's place, just like me and JD are, and this 19-year-old kid comes in, and he wants to be interviewed. Nobody wants to see the guy except Rob volunteers, goes out, talks to him for half an hour. It turns out later on this kid, he's got a father who's some kind of Daddy Warbucks, and he calls up Rob and he says, I want to give you all my top search assignments. So this is the topic is the best lesson you've ever learned in recruiting. So Rob's lesson is, you know, be nice to everybody. But I got to tell you, here's my point of view. I've helped hundreds of losers who call me up begging for help, and I never made a nickel out of it. So I think Rob heard this in Sunday school. I don't know where. He's trying to pass it off as a nice kind of story, and the result for me is no vote for him. Dave, what's your opinion?
I'm gonna hold my vote on that. I think that recruiters, broadly speaking, need to be nicer. I think that the industry has got a bad rap, and I think that it's awfully easy to be glib and throw people away, but I hear you. I think that people often come at work and working from a position of desperation, so you're probably going to give a lot more than you get.
JD, opinion?
It's not my favorite one.
Okay. Rob's going to hear that, okay? Next thing, Dave. Okay, let me see. What was that I wanted to ask you next? Okay, Dave, what question do I have? Andrew Merritt said something on your old blog. It's fair if I say this, isn't it? Actually, he linked to it. He says, too many recruiting departments are inwardly focused rather than customer focused. So many do far more damage to the corporate brand than they do to build it. That's a pretty serious charge, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Is it true? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Why?
I think it has something to do with company culture. If you work with an engineering company, the HR people act like engineers. If you work with a bank, the HR people act like they're bankers. They, I think, step back from the core competency, which is, doesn't matter where I work, I have a professional area of expertise. It's HR, and within that, it's recruiting. And they become too focused on fitting into the company culture, on mirroring the company culture back to it, and therefore do a lot of damage to the organization's ability to brand itself. One of the reasons that chief marketing officers typically only last 2 or 3 years in their roles isn't because they're lame, it's because what organizations need is they need a new way of seeing themselves. If that's going to sit in recruitment, recruiters are accountable for that because ultimately they're the clients that drive the way agencies experience and express their organizational brands.
So you're saying there's a natural tendency towards groupthink and conformity, and someone comes in fresh, they're polluted or contaminated by the problems pretty soon in the self-image. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of organizations do that almost purposefully. Microsoft is famous for hazing people for a period of months as they come on board to sort of show them the Microsoft way. Other organizations do it less overtly, but it's really hard to be a parrot in a cage full of sparrows. You know,
so they need a liaison, a middleman like you, to communicate with the new recruits or to people who they want to bring in as buck privates before they indoctrinate them. They're not necessarily going to be turned on by that company culture. Is that right?
Well, that's not quite what I'm saying. What I'm really trying to say is I think HR needs to remember that we're not banks. We're not engineers. We are professionals in our own sphere. And you need to feel, as somebody who works in HR, comfortable and capable within your space sufficiently so that you can go into an organization and not start to match the culture. Okay, you've got to match the dress code and you've got to work the hours and so on, but beyond that, you don't have to become a drone that looks and acts just like everyone else who actually is part of the core business.
Give me an example. Let's bring it down to real life.
Sure. Okay, I'll give you two companies. Think about Google. What comes to mind when you think about Google as a place to work?
Do no evil.
Do no evil. Okay, but as a place to work, forget about the logo. What would it be like to work in Google?
I don't know. Snacks all day, fun. I don't know. But someone else there? Anybody want to pipe in? Working at Google? There's a lot of people on. Nobody wants to say anything. JD?
Yeah. Who do you think has the best lesson?
No. Okay, he's on another planet. Okay, you go ahead, Dave. You tell me
what
you think.
So the point is, most people, if you talk to them about Google, would say, based on what I've seen, based on the best place to work. I'd imagine Google would be a really fun place to work. A lot of energy, very youthful culture, gets things done, a lot of spark and pizzazz. Now, imagine somewhere like Citibank. Imagine what it would be like to work at Citibank. You're not going to imagine the same kind of work environment. You probably are going to imagine something like, at the very best, casual Fridays. Pretty buttoned up, pretty careful, pretty conservative. Now, take your typical HR person, put him in Google, put her in Google. You would imagine that they would quickly adapt to that Google culture. Put him in the bank, they would change and adapt to the bank culture. My point is simply, at the end of the day, they're in a separate profession. They're not engineers. They're not part of that Google cell. They're not finance people. They're not part of that banking cell. They're in a different sector and need to understand themselves differently, so that they can be the ones, not the agency, but at the point of contact, they can be the ones who can translate for the prospective hires. Listen, this is what life at Google is like from a third-party perspective, from an I'm not it, that's it. If it fits you, I'll get you there perspective. Does that make sense?
No, because if you're one of the team, you're going to tell them what it's like, and that's what it's really like, right? I mean,
but you're not one of the team if you sit in HR. I beg to differ. HR lives in a different vertical. They have a different work experience. I'm not there with my 80-20 rule at Google working on a great innovative HR project. Okay, maybe that's a bad example. Maybe they extend it to HR, but you get the idea. I'm not the core business that Google does. Unless I work somewhere like Hewitt or Towers in a real HR consultancy, that's not the company's core business.
Okay, you know what? Let's go to a contestant because she addressed this very issue. Her name's Heather Hartman, and she says if you're a recruiter, you really have to know the business you're recruiting in order to do a good job. I personally say, oh, yeah, more power to her, but I think it's a personality issue because there's a lot of recruiting generalists who make a lot of money, and they don't do it that way. But what you're talking about is sort of what she's talking about knowing the business. I'm saying that it seems to me if HR fits in, they're just part of the business. They know the business culture, and that's if they're telling the truth about the firm, that's what they're going to be recruiting, presenting in their recruiting marketing efforts. You're saying, let's not argue about it. Let me just ask you this.
I think we're almost in the same place. I think the distinction is knowing the business versus being the business. I agree with Heather completely. You have to know the business, but you have to have sufficient detachment to understand it from an outside perspective. You can't become so chameleon-like that you forget there's a process people go through when they go from outside to inside that you have to understand and help move them through.
Oh, you have to help change them.
Knowing and being, right.
Okay, let me ask you this. How well do you have to know an industry in order to do an advertising campaign for them?
Well, it depends on the industry. I think you have to know them really, really well. But
let me interrupt. Okay, no, I was going to say Heather doesn't win, but maybe you're going to say something that supports her. You go ahead.
Oh, well,
you have to know them really well.
I'm selling my own line of business here, which is brand strategy, which starts with a lot of research. So obviously I've got a vested interest in saying,
what is brand strategy?
Well, it's saying given all of the things in the universe we could say about an organization, number one, what's true? Number two, what do participants in the internal scheme of things care about? Number three, what are prospects inclined to believe is true? Number four, where's the organization going? That is, we don't want to sell you a job that's going to cease to exist the day after tomorrow or a strategic direction that's about to change. Meld all of those together and you have positioning opportunities out of which you can drive a brand strategy, which is to say the big set of ideas that individual advertising campaigns will be built out of.
Okay, so let me ask you this. We're going to come back to another contestant in a second. But you were in China, you were in Vietnam, any other countries?
Yeah, I've been in United Kingdom and...
No, I mean just recently. Were you in England?
Yeah. I got back from Russia last week.
Okay, so walk me through one of your days there. So you're the global VP of brand strategy. What do you do when you visit these cities?
Well, it depends. I'm doing two kinds of things. When I'm doing client research, I typically get there and I spend all my time either walking around or conducting focus groups. I walk around, look in bookstores, try to find out what kinds of advice there are for job seekers. I talk to people to try to find out their perceptions of the local market, to find out, is this a market in which it's about referrals, where they go online? Is it a market in which they're looking to somewhere like Kelly to try to find a job for them? And then we hold client-specific focus groups that spend a lot of time trying to understand the things we're talking about now. In the universe of employers, where is our client? What kinds of things do the prospects look for from work and from working? If they're internal groups, we're trying to get a sense of the workaday reality in the sense of what we call the aspirational reality of working, not your best day ever, but, you know, your best day this week or the next couple of weeks, what makes you want to come in early, stay late, do a great job beyond pay and benefits. So that's one set of work. The other set of work is a lot of client meetings, a lot of client presentations, and a lot of in-selling once we've done the work to say, yeah, here's how it fits with your consumer brand, here's how you can use this in campaigns, here's how it might extend over time.
So you're a salesman?
No, I'm a researcher masquerading as a salesman.
Okay. Pam Clotten, I like to call her Lottie Miss Clottie. She says it's never good to pressure a candidate into taking a job or a client into accepting a candidate, because if they don't love each other for real, it's not going to work. So, Dave, you yourself have a philosophy about sales, including closing and pressure at that point.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the nice thing about the recruitment advertising space is when we talk about what we're selling, we're always talking about selling the truth, right? So it's really more about messaging than selling. And similarly, when I'm talking to clients about doing these large-scale research projects, it's not about the sizzle, it's really about the steak. The advertising is the sizzle, and at the end of the day, what we're trying to say is, if you go through the process correctly, we can't guarantee you brilliant creative, but we can guarantee you that the creative will speak to what the candidates are interested in. The creative side of the house is are the folks accountable for the brilliance.
Okay, do you promise like numbers or anything like that? Do you have a quota?
No, it's a really good question. It's very interesting. Often the conversations start around metrics. Clients tend to be very metrics focused, but at the end of the day, two things happen. One of them is when the work is all done, the client's suddenly not interested in measurement anymore. They want to see the ads up. They want to see stuff elevated. And the kinds of typical recruitment metrics, time to fill, so on and so forth, are sufficient. The other challenge is built into the kind of advertising we do. Unlike product advertising, where you're spending millions and millions of dollars and getting tons of impressions, recruitment advertising is typically only visible to people when they're seeking and visible through much smaller placements. So when you're looking at the effectiveness of the ad dollar spend, it's much harder to measure internally. It's much more effective to measure it in terms of whether it is in alignment with what prospects want. And you see that in terms of retention over time. You see it in terms of time to fill, but you don't see it like, okay, it's 1 month after the campaign launched, where's my deck of numbers? It just doesn't work that way.
They never come back and argue with you about that?
No.
Okay. Okay, Pam doesn't win. I agree with her, too, that you shouldn't pressure a candidate, you shouldn't pressure, but a large part of recruiting, JD, correct me if I'm wrong, is talking people into things. Am I right about that?
Well,
anybody?
I think that recruiters who just sort of let things happen as they happen aren't going to do as well as someone who gets an offer on the table. He wants to get that closed and accepted.
Nobody else? There must be some recruiters out there. Anybody else want to comment on that? Okay. None of them are talking. They must be your friends. They're very shy, JD. Okay.
I'm not good on radio.
Pardon me?
I said I'm not good on radio.
I'm not talking to you. Okay. Now, Dave.
Nervous, Mike.
Yes? Sorry, can't hear you.
I said I'm very nervous right now.
Okay. Be nervous. Okay, you know, I know you. Okay, we'll go. Anyway, Dave, I'm back to you.
All right.
You're the guest. You know, you said you went to Vietnam. What does he need advertising for jobs in Vietnam? I was flabbergasted. It seems like a primitive country to me. You wouldn't be advertising to find people for jobs.
No, you know, it's absolutely on fire. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the world right now. And I think that the fact that China is maturing so fast and that the market – if you look at where India is now, one of the things that people are saying about India is, you know what, it's becoming in some ways an uncompetitive market. People are hopping from job to job to job every 2 to 3 years, and every time they do, they're getting a 20% pay increase. The result is the cost of an Indian hire is going up and up and up. We're starting to see that pressure in China now, too, with a lot of MNCs coming into China, setting up shop.
What's an MNC? Don't know what it is.
Sorry, multinational companies.
Okay.
Setting up shop, increasing the wage base, and competing with each other for a limited talent pool. That progression has started to raise wages across China, and so multinationals are looking for other places that have similar talent profiles. And Vietnam, since it's opened up, has actually become fairly business-friendly and is a good market in some ways for the right kinds of employers.
So are they like China, where it's a communist country, but they have a lot of foreign free businesses there?
Yes. I'd say if you want to make a spectrum with China at the far end of the spectrum in terms of general business friendliness, Vietnam's not there yet, but they are moving rapidly to become more business friendly. And you see this in everything from it's a little bit of a hassle when you're at the airport to get your visa, but you can get it. You can get through things. There are infrastructure challenges that the country's working on. It's not as rich a country, but it's doing what it can at the speed it can, and it's actually moving pretty fast because it's, relatively speaking, quite small.
Okay. J.D., do you know Penny Goodman?
I do.
She's a very funny girl. She's a contestant. She didn't win. Okay, back to you, Dave. Just I got to keep going through these people here. Okay, now you got a PhD, right?
Yes.
In what?
English.
English. Now let me ask you this. Jane Austen, if she was better looking, do you think she would have been just an equally good author as she is?
Well, it's a great question. I think you'd have to change a couple of other things. I think you'd have to ask whether she's as social as she was and whether that left her enough time to write. Listen, she's a brilliant woman, and if she spent the time writing she spent, I think she would have been as good as she was.
Even if she was good-looking?
She's not that bad-looking. Come on.
No, seriously, she's a plain Jane. Everybody,
plain Jane,
I assume, knows the Pride and Prejudice. In fact, here's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. If anybody doesn't know, Pride and Prejudice is about a family with five daughters or six, you know, and it's written the heroine is kind of a plain Jane, real smart girl, sarcastic, and she gets the guy in the end, right? Is that it in a nutshell? Is that fair? We're going to go with that. Yeah, but when they make a movie of it, Elizabeth Bennet, the heroine, she's always gorgeous. Greer Garson in the 40s, Jennifer Ayle. In the 90s or 5 years ago, whenever it was, very beautiful girl, and Keira Knightley most recently, right? Now, that tells you something about popular taste. They like pretty girls. They don't like intellectual, sarcastic people. And I'm wondering how that, you can debate me on that, but I think the fact of the movies proves that I'm right. How does that affect something like recruitment advertising? People want some message that isn't necessarily true.
You know, I was waiting to see if you're going to be able to bring it back to recruitment advertising, and I'm impressed. That's really good. I don't know that people want to see something that's not true. I do think that they want to see the attractive parts of what an employer has to offer, and I think by and large, the kinds of employers that do recruitment advertising have something attractive to offer. Look, that's going to vary from market to market. If you're Walmart, maybe the attractive thing you have to offer is a job, right? If you're Genentech, maybe the attractive thing you have to offer is an absolutely fabulous job, better than anybody else. But in every case, it's a competitive market, and the nature of market competition is such that you're going to have to put your best foot forward. And yet, you can't be successful if people leave after 6 to 9 months. It takes, on average, 9 months for somebody to become fully functional in a new role. So you've got to tell enough truth.
Where did you get that statistic?
Oh, I don't
9
remember.
Months.
Yeah, I don't remember. It's a high-tech stat. I can look it up
Okay.
And send something to you. But it's an average time to competency. I think it may be from the Gold Book. It's an average time to competency. That is to say that until somebody's been around for a certain period of time, which varies from sector to sector, obviously it's a lot shorter in fast food, and it's a lot longer if you're going to be a professor of something, but I think the average is around 9 months, you're not recouping your investment. So if I want to hire people, I've got to have them longer than it takes them to figure out I've lied to them and quit. So what that means for recruitment advertising, at the end of the day, goes back to what I've been saying all along, is you've got to tell the truth. Now, you can be selective in what you emphasize because, like all advertising, it's ultimately about differentiation, what we've got, what they don't have, what we've got that you want that they don't have, but you're not going to be able to say it's perfect, we'll give you $1 billion and you never have to show up because life just isn't like that.
Okay, okay, okay. Now, we got a guy, we got a contestant here. His name is Moises Lopez. He's in Texas, real nice guy. I've spoken to him on the phone. I suggest that he takes a new name, Molo. You know? I think it's a good brand. It worked for her. And I also think he should start wearing tight jeans as well.
I like it.
Yeah, thank you, honey. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, he's a sorcerer, just like you. That's Maureen. Anyway, but Dave, his theory is that you shouldn't be afraid to ask stupid questions and that that is a way to elicit all the information you need from a candidate. Now, I ask a lot of stupid questions. You know that, right? What do you think of his strategy?
You're talking about during the interview process.
Yeah.
And I guess my question would be, why wouldn't you ask stupid questions? It seems like you've got pretty much a captive audience, and by probing in all directions, you're more likely to crack the facade. Look, it's a competitive game to a certain extent. The candidate wants to reveal as little as they can that might lessen their chances of getting what they want, and essentially that's boiled up in their resume. The recruiter wants to get around that and find out what the real deal is, so I'm all for it.
So it's like a pattern interrupt to confuse the guy. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay, but at the same time, isn't the interviewer representing the brand of the company? If he acts like a nut, saying stupid things, then what's the person going to think of the company? He's going to think a bunch of nuts work here. The departmental brand will be different from the company brand. I'm never going to let that go, by the way.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, it really depends, doesn't it? It depends on whether the recruiter is a company recruiter or a third-party recruiter, which is what I assumed from your question, but it also depends on the company culture. Clearly, if you're recruiting for a very prestigious brand, there's going to be a brand challenge if the questions are too out there and too stupid. I guess when you were talking about stupid questions, I was hearing off-the-wall questions.
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not the contestant, it's him.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Is he talking about asking stupid questions to do sourcing or asking stupid questions to do recruiting?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know if it relates to Dr. Kippen here, but it was for recruiting. When you've got, just like he said, a candidate in the interview, and you're asking questions that you're not sure about or stuff like that.
All right.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Why, do you ask stupid questions when you're sourcing?
All the time.
Give me an example. Sorry, Dave, we have to hear this. It's very important.
No, good.
let's see. I go into...
Do you know Maureen?
No, I don't.
Maureen Sharif, the queen bee of telephone sourcing.
No, so you say.
She is. Go ahead, shoot.
I just go in and I ask, can you please tell me who? You know, I don't feel that I need to know a whole lot of information in order to find people that hold specific titles.
Yeah.
So... You know, I don't call in and sound like...
You think that's a stupid question, saying who's the production manager in this company?
No, it's not a stupid question, but...
I'd say it would be a stupid question if you asked who's the mother of the production manager.
Yeah. Or a stupid question might be termed like, oh my goodness, can you help me? I just spilled tomato soup down the front of my drawer.
Yeah, who knows? You know, like I remember Art Linkletter used to try to get people to keep somebody on the line.
Exactly.
You never know what you can get out of it. Okay, you're off the phone. Let me see. Okay, so Dave, I forgot what I was going to ask you next. Let's go to another contestant, okay? You're giving great answers. I really didn't expect it, I got to tell you. Hey, everybody, isn't he giving good answers when I ask him about these contestants? I'm very impressed, by the way.
Very good answers.
Okay. Oh, let me ask you this first. So you got a PhD. I've recruited PhDs before. I have. And I found they didn't make that much money. And I'm wondering, you know, what's the point? I mean, from a job point of view. Although, you know what? For the jobs that I was recruiting for, and I can think of, I needed some yogurt experts, believe it or not, you know, you had to have a PhD, really, to get that job. What's your opinion of PhDs in the workplace?
It all depends on the sector. Listen, if you're recruiting for someone in the high-tech sector, if you're recruiting for Intel, for example, I guarantee you that they have PhDs, and I guarantee you their PhDs makes really, really good money. Same if you're recruiting for Exxon and you're talking to people with PhDs in petroleum engineering. I think the what you're talking about is for a lot of people who get a PhD, it's largely a labor of love, and it doesn't translate into earnings. But it's never, in that case, really about the earnings at the end of the day. Maybe the folks you recruited really, really loved yogurt. I don't know.
Well, I got some of them from a brewery. They didn't get the job. The yogurt guys did. Anyway, what about you? Why did you get a PhD?
Labor of love.
Oh, yeah? What was
your
thesis about? Jane Austen?
No, it was actually my, within the doctorate in English, my area was rhetoric, and my particular area of interest was the South African novel. I found it incredibly interesting to look at the way the South African novel in English was used to prop up the various pieces of the state system of apartheid. So my dissertation was about this writer, Sarah Gertrude Millen, who had a disproportionately large hand in that, and I could go on and on about.
Hey, you know what? I only know two authors from South Africa, and they're both like with Nadine Gordimer's from South Africa, right?
Right.
And the one we took in high school, "Cry the Beloved Country." What was his name? Alan something.
Alan Payton.
Yeah, I mean, he was against apartheid too, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of writers, particularly in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, who are anti-apartheid. Alan Payton was a little bit earlier. The writer I'm talking about, Sarah Gertrude Millen, was profoundly for apartheid, which is incredibly interesting because she was Jewish. She left Lithuania in 1889 because her family was trying to escape Russian pogroms against the Jews, and yet she herself became one of the strongest advocates for this idea of blood purity that ran through apartheid but also ran through the Nazi National Socialism. So for me, the fascinating thing was how patterns of thought can become so powerful that people are completely blind to the incredible contradictions between various propositions they happen to believe. And that's kind of a good lead into advertising, if you think about it.
Go ahead, because it sounds like what you were talking about before, when people come into a company culture and they get absorbed by it.
Yeah, I think, so I didn't go into my doctoral area to work in advertising, to make it perfectly clear, but
uh-huh.
I did learn a lot in those examples about how the mechanisms of groupthink and public thought work, and I think that's helped me a lot in thinking about the work I do. But to be clear, again, my work is not about doing that. It's about trying to help companies undo it and get really clear on what the offer actually is. I think the wall I most often have to try to break through is particularly among senior leadership, the senior leaders who say, we know what we're about. We know why people come to work here. We know what they want. Well, they don't. But until you go talk to their employees and talk to the people they're trying to recruit, they don't have the evidence to the contrary to challenge those, here's why I came to work here, propositions that brought them there in the first place.
So if we talk to a hiring manager, and some of them are like dumb, we talk to them and we say, why would someone want to work here? What are the attractions? They have a hard time coming up with something. So you're saying people who work in the industry without coaching cannot really sell it to somebody outside the industry. Is that fair?
Well, I think there are two challenges there. One is you're talking to hiring managers, and again, they don't typically do the work. So if I'm a hiring manager for Google, I'm sorry, but I'm not an engineer, and all I can do
you're
is
not?
Tell you.
You're not a recruiting manager.
I'm a recruiter, right? I'm sorry, I mistook your question. I'm talking about the recruiter himself.
See, that's what struck me. You're saying people in the business, they might not know what the guys outside the business.
No. Sorry. No, what I'm saying is senior leadership who manages the people doing the business
mm-hmm.
and came on an eon ago and have been running the corporate ship, they were hired 20 years ago when the company was a completely different company and the strategy was different. They've changed the strategy, but they've lost track of what the reality on the ground is. So the hiring manager will know, but the better person to talk to is the peer of the person we're trying to hire on the inside of the company and outside. So who's the competitive set? Who can we talk to in that competitive set and find out what would it take somebody like you to consider working somewhere like my company?
You know, I've never had that experience, at least not that I remember, where a hiring manager said, look, talk to my guys, find out why they're working here, stuff like that. Never had that kind.
I think you might find it really interesting to get a download from a hiring manager on what he or she thinks the main advantages are and then talk to some of the workforce. Look for differences. You'll typically find a lot of them.
Okay. We're going to have to come to the winner soon. I'm going to have to spend a bit of time on him. What important questions have I not asked you?
I don't know. I can't think of a one.
Come on.
Well, let me ask you one. So how did you get the recruiting animal?
Well, pardon me?
Where did that come from?
You know what? I was a Canadian headhunter when I was on recruiting.com. JD was my partner with Anthony J. Meany, and I called up a company to sell an ad, and she hadn't looked at our blog before. She took a look. She said, the Canadian headhunter, I don't want anything to do with Canada. So when I left recruiting.com, I said, I want to sell ads someday. I can't be the Canadian headhunter anymore. And here's something interesting. Maybe it relates to advertising. I just read an article on brainstorming. I always figured these are real hackneyed things. But I said, okay, I'm going to do what they said. So I just sat here at my desk, right where I'm sitting now, and I went through a bunch of different, I went through the alphabet trying to come up with names, and that's how I came up with it. That's a story for posterity.
Going back to our first conversation, do people treat you differently now that you're the recruiting animal? Have people resisted your name change, or do they not care?
They don't care. It's been a year. I don't notice. You know, I'll have to tell you one thing. Before we go to the winner, we got to get to the winner. I want your opinion about what he's saying. Now, because you're an expert on selling people, and this is an amazing sell, okay? But I can't remember what I was talking about. I can't remember. It was something to do with changing names. But anyway, let's go to the winner. Let's go to the winner. But I had a really good question, and I can't remember it. JD, do you know what I was going to ask him?
I don't.
Oh, geez, that's too bad. Anyway, okay, let's go on. The winner is Harry Joyner, the marketing headhunter. And here's why. Dave, listen to this. This guy says he can get his candidates to help each other get a job. When he sends someone out for an interview, and that person, he finds out right away if that guy has struck out or not. And his specialty is kind of, he's someone you should know. He recruits online marketing specialists. He's a really good salesman, I think, personally, funny, articulate, kind of intellectual marketing guy. And he gets these candidates, after they've struck out, to go to the next guy in the line and prep him on the interview. Now, these guys are natural competitors. I can't imagine that happening in my world. So because his advice was very specific and seems like, I know he's been going to church lately. He wrote about it on his blog, believe it or not. And so, you know, maybe he heard about the lion laying down with the lamb or something like that. It just seems so amazing to me. I think he's got to get the prize. What do you think, Dave?
Oh, yeah, I think that's fantastic. I think that's absolutely a fantastic suggestion.
Now, let me ask, is Harry Joyner on this call?
You know what? He's not. He had he had something he had to tell.
Yeah, he knew I was going to ask him a question because I was going to ask the exact words that he uses to sell that. I know him, though. I believe he did it, and so he's going to win. We'll talk to him about it another time. So let me see, Dave, how much time I have left. I got 6 minutes. Do you have another 6 minutes for us?
You bet.
Okay, people in the audience, I want you to give a shot at Dave. Anything you want to ask him. He's a tough guy, you can tell. He's good at batting them out. I think you're quick on your feet. You're very good at batting them out when they come at you.
Thank you.
Maureen?
Yeah, can you
talk? Are you the only one on the line?
I don't know.
Go ahead.
I hope so, so I can have all of the remaining time. Can you talk some more about that the thought stream that you talked before? What was her name, Gertrude?
Oh, Sarah Gertrude Millen.
Sarah Gertrude, okay.
Yeah.
Can you talk some more about that? That was interesting.
Well,
do you want him to talk about it and relate it to recruiting? Go ahead, Dave. You go ahead.
Relates it to.
Whatever you want.
Okay.
Well, I can tell you that her books are really hard to find in the United States for pretty obvious reasons, and I think that for most modern readers, the way she writes, the things she says, they're pretty horrific, and I think the amazing thing about her is that coming from where she came from, seeing what she saw. She actually was a witness at the Nuremberg trials. She was a close friend of General Smuts, who you may know was one of the founders of the Charter for the United Nations. She was a very influential person. During the Second World War, she tried very hard to get the quota on the number of Jews who could emigrate from Germany to South Africa raised unsuccessfully. She clearly understood what the Germans were doing. She clearly understood what these ideas of blood purity were all about, and yet she was so blinded by her national context, by the ideology of apartheid, that she never made the connection between what she was advocating for and advocating against.
Yeah, but Nadine Gordimer is also Jewish, right?
Yes.
Right, so...
Totally different generation. I think by the time Nadine came up, apartheid had become so awful that the scales really came off. If you read a story like Berger's Daughter, which is a kind of her coming-of-age story, but also a story of the foundation of the South African Communist Party, which she initially was very enamored of, it's very clear what her girlish perspective was. She started out, obviously, white, privileged, with a set of blinders on about what was going on, and you see the scales coming off during the story, and it's absolutely heartbreaking to see her disappointment, her deep disappointment in her country and her impotence to do anything about it.
Joe Slovo, also Jewish, right?
Sorry?
Joe Slovo, leader of the Communist Party of South Africa. You're talking about, why are these people different? Was it a generational thing?
Why are they different from Gordimer? Absolutely.
No, he was on the same, let's say, the same kind of track as Gordimer. You're talking about this other woman, Gertrude,
yes.
I've never heard of before.
It's different from Millen, then.
Yeah.
I think it's a generational thing. Remember, she's born in 1889. They were born in the 1930s. A lot happened between the 1880s and the 1930s. Millen grew up next to the Vaal River diggings. She grew up in a very hardscrabble environment. Her early memories are of people like Cecil Rhodes and his incredible riches. The path toward the future for South Africa, I think, looked very different to her. And let's face it, racism was institutionalized in a different way all around the world prior to World War II. I think the United States and South Africa were not nearly so far apart as we'd like to think prior to the Second World War, the big difference being that after the war for the U.S., the scale started to fall off. For South Africa, it took a lot longer.
Okay. Got to go back to recruiting. Anybody else? No? I think Larry Lawrence Houghton came on. Larry, are you there?
It's not a recruiting question, but I...
Go ahead, shoot. You got a few minutes.
It's been a great...
Oh, you know Larry Houghton. Dave, I talked to you about him.
Yep.
He's in San Francisco as well. You guys shouldn't be calling here. You should be talking locally. But go ahead, Larry.
Calls are free now.
Yeah.
Listen, great conversation, great interview, particularly because a lot of the stuff I think regarding branding seems like snake oil and flamboyant nonsense and smoke and mirrors, and you've really studied it and you've thought it through and you've talked really a lot of good sense today. My question is, am I wrong in thinking that a lot of what comes under the heading of branding is just BS?
No,
or do you have the same
right.
impression?
You're absolutely right. I think in this space, it's very new. People have only been having this conversation for 4 or 5 years, but now it's a buzzword, and a lot of people are trying to just get some money out of it. I think, broadly speaking, all of the majors who are working in this are doing a good job and doing things in similar ways. I think, obviously, I've got some personal bias here. I think TMP is far and away the best at it, but I think there also is a lot of spin, a lot of smoke and mirrors out there, particularly at the boutique level, because it is new and there aren't commonly accepted standards. There aren't commonly accepted deliverables. You ask 10 employers who have talked to you about their delight in their employment brand to show you their employee value proposition or their brand position, they'll show you completely different things. And I'm not talking about one has 3 words, one has 4. I'm talking about zebras and oranges different.
Wow.
Okay, we're going in a whole new area. It makes me want to ask more questions. We only got 1 minute left. So I'm going to end the show. Any last words, Dave Kippen?
Thank you very much. It's been a blast. I'm glad you invited me on, and I look forward to listening to you from here on in.
Well, you're going to be on again. I don't know when. Thank you, everybody. Congratulations, Harry Joyner. That's the show for today. Goodbye, everybody.